ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The economy, stupid, is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land. We're told AI will change our world. We're told it's the most transformative technology since the internet, that it will revolutionise industry, enhance human capabilities, solve our ills. Later in the show, we talk to Professor Emily Bender about her book, The AI Con. She reckons it's time to question the hype. But first, the strange connection between Teddy Roosevelt and the panda bear. In 1929, the two eldest sons of former President Theodore Roosevelt trekked through the Himalayas searching for the giant panda. Many things went wrong, but they found and shot a panda, winning much acclaim by bringing home its skeleton and pelt. A hunting frenzy followed. Nathalia Holt is a historian and author who explores beautifully intriguing corners of history. She's written about the women spies of ASIO, women space pioneers, women animators in Hollywood. Now she's written The Beast in the Clouds, the Roosevelt brothers' deadly quest to find the mythical giant panda. Nathalia joins us from California. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nathalia, how could there have been any doubt in the West that pandas existed?
It's hard to imagine, but there was a time when pandas were only hypothesized. They were not clear, and in fact, many scientists believe they might not exist at all. And it started in 1869 when a pelt of a panda was first sent to a museum in France. And so little was known about this animal. Nothing was known about where it lived or what it ate. And so there was really this passion among scientists to find out more. But decades passed, and still no specimen of the panda had been brought for scientists to study. So by the time the Roosevelts left, it had been 60 years of people guessing that this animal existed, but with no real proof. And in fact, even in China, because of the country is so large, many people there also did not know about pandas either. There certainly weren't records in museums or with scientists at the time.
Paintings? Images?
Even that was lacking. Yes, it has a lot to do with where China was at that moment, because you have this vast country that is not easy to get around in. There are not many roads. And so you have the section that pandas living in is quite far from others. And so while it was an animal that people in that region knew about, many people in other parts of China did not know about the panda.
Exploring the world looking for game was a bit of a Roosevelt family tradition.
That's right. Certainly Teddy Roosevelt has this rich history of expeditions and going out to find animals. He was a man that believed strongly in conservation, in protecting wildlife, and he believed that hunting was an essential part of that. And certainly at the time that his two eldest sons, Ted and Kermit, decide to undertake this expedition, they believe very much as their father did, that hunting is the way forward. It's the way to protect animals. And in fact, many scientists at the time believed that shooting animals and that killing endangered species was the way to protect them. And what's interesting is how much that changed with this expedition.
But give us the logic of that. How does shooting animals, endangered species, protect them?
So the thinking at the time was that nature had made its choice, that these animals were doomed, they were not going to survive, there was nothing that humans could do. And so the best thing, scientists believe, was to capture them, to kill them, and then to be able to study them. So at least there would be some record of their existence and that they could be compared to other species. It's hard for us to wrap our brains around it, but this was really the way that many scientists thought in this period of history.
No, there's a rough logic to that. There's a rough logic to it. If you believe that nothing humans could do would save a doomed species, it was good to have one or two in a museum. But did these boys go out on their father's expeditions? Was it he who taught them how to go about hunting for strange, difficult, and lost animals?
Absolutely. He spent many, many hours and days, months, years even with his sons, teaching them about hunting, taking them on expeditions, especially his son Kermit. So Kermit went with him on a trip to Africa. He also went with him on an expedition to the River of Doubt after Teddy Roosevelt lost the 1912 election. And there, you see that there is this pattern in Teddy Roosevelt's behavior where after a loss, he often went on an expedition. And that same pattern is repeated in his sons. When they embark on this panda expedition, they're both at a very low point in their lives. They're looking to prove themselves.
Why were they at such a low point? The difficulties of living with a great man father?
Well, certainly I think there are many advantages to having a famous father, but also many difficulties. And Teddy Roosevelt, while he was an incredibly affectionate father, I mean, he was the kind of dad that would get down on the floor and play with his children, but he could also be hard on them. And especially Kermit, he worried that Kermit would become a weakling. And so what we see is that at this point in 1928, when they're about to undertake this expedition, their father has been dead for a decade. And Ted, so he's the eldest son, has had a great difficulty. He wanted to follow in his father's footsteps and become a politician, but instead he became embroiled in scandal in Washington, D.C., and his political career is over. He will never become a politician. And instead, it is FDR, of course, who goes on with the Roosevelt name. And Kermit as well has had difficulties. His shipping business is faltering. He's having difficulties at home. And so both of them are really ready to leave, much as their father did, and undertake this expedition. And very few people think they will be successful. I mean, you have to remember at this point, there have been so many expeditions to find the panda from the West. So many museums have sent out explorers. No one has come back with the panda. And so certainly nobody thinks that this very small expedition funded by a museum in Chicago and led by the Roosevelts will be the one to be successful.
How did they go about it? What made the difference for their expedition?
Certainly there was a lot of passion among the brothers, but also their group was very well formed. You know, because they were smaller, they were traveling lighter, they were able to go farther than other expeditions. And they decided to go to a part of China that they had been warned many times not to go to. They had been told that savages lived there and that if they went there, they would be killed. And it was a difficult decision to go against all of the knowledge of Westerners that had been given to them. But they decided to enter this part of China where the Yi people live. And of course, what they find are not savages at all, but people whose knowledge of the panda is quite a bit greater than theirs and who help them find the panda,
help us, to their chagrin. Sorry, help us with the map. Where are we in China?
So this is in Western China. And so the Roosevelts end up taking a very long expedition. So they start on the border with India and they end up moving through the Himalayas, across the Tibetan Plateau. They cover 1,000 miles in about 5 months, and it is an incredible trek. They go through so many different areas. They pass through so many cultures. They find themselves in the middle of a civil war that they are very much not prepared for. They have some very close calls, especially in the Himalayas, where they suffer from altitude sickness. They meet with bandits. They lose their food. Many, many things go wrong. And it's certainly a difficult, trying expedition.
Were they incompetent?
Well, you can imagine that travel at that time is not quite the same as today. There aren't roads. You know, they are having to travel on their feet and using mules to carry their expeditions. They were fortunate to be accompanied by guides who were sort of like the Sherpa people in Nepal. And these were men and women who knew the way, who carried the equipment, who made camp. And it's really thanks to them, that, of course, that they were able to find the panda. And they also had some very, very competent members of their expedition. And one of those that I found really interesting to write about is named Taijack Young. And he was young. He was only 18. He was an NYU student whose father was from China and whose mother was from San Francisco. And he had such experience that he was able to bring, not so much in languages as he had promised, but in other ways, he was able to aid the expedition greatly.
How big was the expedition? You make it sound as though it was a small army crossing the Tibetan Plateau.
For the time, it was quite small, because you have the two Roosevelts, and then you have Taijack Young, who is going as their interpreter and scientist. You have Herbert Stevens, who is a British naturalist. And then you have Sudham Cutting, who is an American naturalist. So with this group, you then have a number of guides. But altogether, it's very small for an expedition, certainly much less so than others of the time.
Were they keeping journals?
They were, and that was very helpful to me.
Yes, I'm wondering,
every day
what
on the
have
trail.
You got?
Yes, in fact, they all kept journals, and this was wonderful for me because I was able to compare the stories between each of them for the events on the trail, and that really let me put in a lot of detail about what happened. I really wanted the reader to feel like they're immersed with them in the Himalayas. And then I also was able to get the unpublished autobiography of Taijack Young, as well as some interviews that he did in the 90s. And so much correspondence between them. It's amazing how well they kept up with each other and how deep their friendships went on, even after the expedition was over.
How glorious to have all of that detail. It must have been thrilling to write.
It was. Oh, so much fun just to really dig into those letters and all of their every part of it was wonderful. But certainly they put in a lot of their personal feelings, what it was like, how they felt, even, you know, what they're wearing, what they're eating, every detail.
What about squabbles and fallings out in the party? Drama?
Yes, a little bit. I suppose you can't have any expedition like this without some drama. Certainly Herbert Stevens gave the Roosevelts a lot of trouble because he tended to be slow. He liked to wander. He liked to explore.
Oh, yes.
Their very first day on the trail, he becomes lost. They can't find him. He just leaves the trail, and
Jesus.
It's this big panic. And eventually, he is just slowing down the expedition so much that they end up leaving him behind. Oh, it's terrible. But fortunately, he is able to continue and meet up with them later, and he's able to make a number of really important discoveries on his own.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live, and I am talking to Nathalia Holt about her account of the Roosevelt brothers' discovery of the panda. Now, Nathalia, we are getting close to the animal now. So were they confident as they trudged on that they would even find an animal? Did they know they were on the right track?
They didn't. They had been searching for so many months in so many landscapes with so many different people that it was very difficult for them to believe they would ever find the animal in the end. And so when they finally find the trail, when they finally find scratches in a tree and they find some scat from a panda, it is this incredible moment because they realize, wow, we're actually here. We're actually going to be able to track down this bear.
But how do they know these are the scats of a bear?
Pandas have very distinct droppings because they only eat bamboo. And so their droppings look very different than other animals. And even in the trees, they use trees to communicate with one another. These are very solitary animals. And so they will rub against their trees and leave hairs. So they could see black and white hairs in the tree along the trail. And it's important to note that at this time, so little was known about the panda that the Roosevelts believed they were meeting an aggressive beast in this bamboo forest. they thought that this would be a cross between a polar bear and a black bear. And they were very much fearful for their lives. I mean, they went in believing that this was the kind of animal they would find.
And I suppose it was the guides who told them, look, bamboo in the scats, scratches on the trees, this is the animal we have always been telling you really does exist.
That's right. The guides were not pleased to finally find a panda because for the people that lived in this area, they knew that pandas were gentle, that these were not aggressive bears. And while they tried to tell the Roosevelts this, they didn't listen. And so it was actually very distressing for the guides because they were hoping they would never find a panda. They didn't want to be on the trail of one at all.
It's a rather American response to the strange and unknown, isn't it? To assume that it's going to be violent and savage and can take your head off. But now let's get to the point where they finally see the bear. Where was it? How close did they get to it? How long did they let it live?
So they found the panda hiding in a dragon spruce tree in this bamboo forest. They spot a head popping out of the tree and they wait. And then when the head pops out again, both brothers fire simultaneously. Immediately, they are expecting the bear to begin attacking them. And of course, that is not what happens. But they end up tracking the animal through the woods. They can see that it's bleeding and they follow it and then finally kill it. And almost immediately, they have regrets about their actions because they realize that what the guides were telling them was true. They are the real savages in this land, and they've just killed this animal that is very gentle. And of course, there ends up being unintended consequences from this hunt. So they bring the animal back. It's much fanfare. Everyone is very excited. People are interested in this new animal. They're going to the museum to see it. And immediately you have hunters who now want to find the panda themselves. And the Roosevelts have made that possible because they've shown where the panda are. And not only that, but you also have individuals who want to go and steal cubs to bring back to American zoos. And so that is happening as well. And the Roosevelts realize that they've caused this. They have made all of this happen.
They didn't think to keep at least somewhat secret the actual location of the animal. I mean, that seems basic.
They did not realize what a large game animal the panda would become. It was unexpected for them, the response. Immediately, there was this pandemonium in the U.S. People were very excited about pandas. Suddenly, there were pandas and jewelry and pictures and all of these things. And so it really created this frenzy. And it just took on a life of its own. So certainly, perhaps if the Roosevelts had known what would happen, they might have changed their minds. But it really got out of control. And so you can imagine that at the point where they're sitting in this hotel room, they're with a woman named Ruth Harkness, who's the first woman to have captured a panda cub and brought it back to the U.S. And she's now auctioning it off to see how much she can get for this poor defenseless cub and all of these zoos. And the Roosevelts are aghast. And someone says to them, well, perhaps one day this little animal will be in an exhibit beside your pandas in the museum. And Ted says, I'd sooner stuff my own son. And it's really from this moment on that we see a big change in the Roosevelts. And they end up adapting their lives and making big changes to address this failure of theirs in the Himalayas.
Before we address that, the pandemonium, as of course it has to be called, has lasted to the present day, hasn't it? This extraordinary excitement about these bears, so much so that the Chinese government rents them out to zoos around the world and Australian prime ministers trek halfway across China to look at one that once lived in the Adelaide Zoo. There is a kind of world fascination with these animals, isn't there?
There is, and that's really thanks to the Roosevelts. They are the ones that introduced the pandas to the West, and you can see why people love them. These are such sweet, gentle animals. These are not animals that attack humans. They're playful. They do cute things and roll down hills and play in the snow. So I think it's very natural that they are so beloved, and it's really thanks to that popularity that you then have all of this wildlife conservation that's happened because of it.
Tell us the link between the two.
So after the Roosevelts came back and they had this regret about what was happening, Kermit decides that he is going to make some changes. And so he ends up becoming president of the Audubon Society, as well as taking another position with the New York Zoological Society.
Now, Huftick, explain to Australian listeners the Audubon Society.
Yes, so these are wildlife conservation societies. These are groups that have been established to protect wildlife in the U.S. and in other parts of the world as well. And so when he joins these groups, he immediately takes a very different approach to exploration and to science. He no longer goes out and hunts bears and large mammals. He doesn't also bring them back to zoos. Instead, he goes on a trip to the Galapagos with another member of the expedition, and they work on a breeding program for the Galapagos tortoises. And so he ends up making a big change in that way. But then the other thing he does is he contacts his the people that he knows in China, and he begins working with them to create laws to protect pandas. And this is something that was very unusual at the time. Although there were other endangered species, there weren't laws to protect them. And so China made this very big move in protecting the panda so that people couldn't go there and hunt it, and they could no longer capture the cubs and bring them back to zoos.
When was this?
And so then this took place about 10 years after the expedition. So it certainly took some time for all of this to coordinate. But we see from both of the brothers that they worked really hard on this endeavor in particular. They were persistent in wanting to get the panda protected.
So this was an initiative of the Chiang Kai-shek regime.
That's right.
And it survived into the communist era?
It did. It did. Of course, as the communist era progressed, there are certainly fewer connections that were happening. There was less travel that was taking place as well.
Of course.
But these were protections that were kept within the country as well, so it wasn't just foreigners.
Right. But meanwhile, there was a small population of these bears in foreign zoos.
That's right. However, these bears did not do well. Sadly.
Why not?
Unfortunately, zookeepers did not understand how to keep these bears alive. And so pandas struggled in U.S. zoos, and ultimately all of the cubs that were brought to the U.S. ended up dying early. And in fact, that one cub that Ruth Harkness had brought, that first cub, did end up in an exhibit as a cub next to the Roosevelts.
Stuffed and dead.
Yes, and interestingly, she also had a change of heart after seeing what happened, and she ends up taking one of the cubs and bringing it back to China and just never wanting any part of this again.
Is there an estimate of the number of pandas that there are living in the world?
There's about 3,000 pandas. That number tends to go up and down. Right now, the pandas are doing fairly well, which is great news. And these protections for pandas have also encompassed protection for the habitat that they reside in. And so that means that pandas end up protecting many other species that they live alongside.
And what happened to the brothers?
So the brothers end up having a sad story, actually. What we see is that while they had real redemption for the part they played in the panda, they do end up having a sad ending. Both of them sign up for World War II and volunteer early. Ted ends up becoming this incredible war hero. He is the first general to land on the beaches of Normandy. He famously says, "We'll start the war right from here," and was incredibly inspiring. Sadly, he dies of a heart attack shortly thereafter. And Kermit precedes him. He also signed up for World War II early and joined the U.S. Army. He was sent to Alaska, but he struggled with depression and with alcoholism throughout his life. And so he ends up committing suicide. And there's a very sad quote from his brother where he says, "He really died 5 years earlier." And in some ways, I think you can really trace the end of the expedition to the start of his depression, because Kermit says in all of his writings, in all of his letters, he speaks about how It's in the wilds where men show you who they really are, and it's where he felt most comfortable. It's something he says many times, that being there with his brother was a wonderful moment for him, a real highlight of his life. And after that, he and his brother end up not getting along, struggling with their communication, and it's a very sad end for Kermit.
I wonder how much the story of the panda is affected by the swirl of publicity that must have affected the lives of anybody called Roosevelt. There was another Roosevelt president in the White House by this time, only a very distant relation, I believe. But these boys lived in and took their expedition through this kind of instant world of publicity. I wonder what it would all have been like if it was a Mr. Smith and a Mr. Jones who took a few guides across the Himalayas and found a panda, just ordinary folk.
It's such a good point, because there are so many expeditions like that. So most animals most large mammals that were discovered and were described by scientists were found by explorers whose names we don't remember, who don't have any animals named after them, and whose stories have really just been lost to history. It's only because they are the Roosevelts that so much has been documented about this expedition. But I think that swirl of publicity that you're talking about certainly has a large impact.
Does the name Kermit live on as a comic book figure?
Do you mean Kermit the Frog?
I do.
Is that what you mean?
I do mean Kermit the Frog. And I wonder, I wonder if Kermit is named after Kermit. It's not a common name.
It's not a common name. I don't know, and that's such a good question. I really am curious myself. I wish I knew the answer.
If you find out, will you let us know, and we'll tell the listeners of Late Night Live, because I think they'd be on the edges of their chairs at the moment as well, wanting to know if that was the survival of this really uncomfortable and bizarre Christian name, Kermit.
I definitely will.
Okay, thank you. We'll hold you to that. I have to ask you, all these books you've written about the particular role of women. What was it like to write a book about the particular role of men?
I enjoy writing about people in history who have not gotten their due. So many of them are women. And I'm sure there'll be more books about women in my future. But it was really something to be able to delve into these stories and to be able to talk about two men and many others on this expedition who I feel haven't gotten their due as well, and who, by elucidating this part of history, it tells us a lot about conservation, about biology, and about preserving endangered species today.
And a last question before I let you go. Can we go to that museum in Chicago and see that panda still?
Yes, you can see the pandas there, and as well as
which
some
museum?
Other, it is the Field Museum in Chicago.
Okay, we'll direct our listeners there as well. Next time in Chicago, that spectacular city, go and look at the panda. Thank you very much, Nathalia. We've enjoyed this
a lot.
I've been speaking to Nathalia Holt, whose book, The Beast in the Clouds, The Roosevelt Brothers' Deadly Quest to Find the Mythical Giant Panda, is published by Simon & Schuster. Coming up, AI. Do not believe the hype. Artificial intelligence, if we're being frank, is a con, a bill of goods you are being sold to line someone's pockets. Those are the feisty words of my guest today, Emily Bender, who a few years ago began a podcast called Mystery AI Hype Theatre 3000. Its message was, don't believe the ridiculous claims of tech boosters and the journalists who fawn over them. One of her primary weapons in her fight is, of course, humour. Dr. Emily Bender is a professor of linguistics at the University of Washington, and her new book is called The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want, co-authored with Alex Hanna. Emily, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Emily, let's look first at the doomers, because you make the argument that the people who say that AI is taking us, you know, the human race to its final destination, and those who say, you know, it's going to create paradise for us all, are two sides of the same coin. Is that right?
Yeah, so they are often presented and present themselves as opposite ends of a spectrum, but in fact, there's very little daylight between. The boosters say AI is a thing, it's inevitable, it's coming really soon, and it's going to solve all of our problems. And the doomers say AI is a thing, it's inevitable, it's coming really soon, and it's going to kill us all. And you can see that it's just that weird turn at the end for both of them that differentiates them, but the mistake and the misapprehension is at the very start of that.
You point out that notions of the human race or even just the creator being destroyed by what is created goes way, way back in the human imagination. It's a pretty primary nightmare, isn't it?
Yes, and a really common trope in our imaginative fiction stories, right? You have, you know, Frankenstein, for example, is an early example, but so also is the figure of the golem in Jewish folklore.
How does the golem operate?
The golem is a clay figure, I believe, who is activated with a certain word. And if you, it does what you've activated it to do, and then problems arise when you forget to deactivate it.
You're not saying there aren't actually considerable dangers in AI, but they're not the dangers the doomers point to. Is that right?
That's right. There's actually not just dangers, but actual harms that we're seeing now across a wide spectrum. So there's environmental degradation, there is labor exploitation behind the systems, there is a displacement of work. It's not that people's that the work is being taken off of people's hands. It's usually being displaced to other people in a much more casualized, gigified economy. There is the ability to automate discriminatory systems and sort of replicate harm faster than we can provide recourse. And there is the pollution of our information ecosystem. And all of these things are happening now. They aren't hypothetical risks, and they're real.
And how do we combat them?
It's tricky. There are things that we can do. I think it depends a little bit for each of the harms. We want to focus in on them. So we want to stand up for workers' rights on the one hand. We want to be very careful about environmental impacts. So whenever a data center is coming in, we need to insist that the people setting it up are completely like on the record with what exactly they're doing with water and electricity. And we want to insist that companies are transparent about what data they've used and where they got it. And we really want to insist on watermarking or some other way of tracking the synthetic media that is just spilling out into our information ecosystem right now without means of cleaning it up.
We may want to do all those things, but the companies who are selling AI are immensely powerful. I mean, only the other day, didn't Canada have to retreat on the fairly obvious notion of taxing these businesses in the face of threats from the United States government?
Yes. So there's power both in terms of the wealth that's been concentrated and then the sort of political deployment of that wealth. But I really think it is worth standing up individually and collectively and not giving up before we've actually entered the fight. And it's disappointing when regulators back down. Similarly, when OpenAI released ChatGPT originally, the Italian GDPR regulator actually banned it for a while on the grounds that they were not handling Italians' data appropriately. And unfortunately, they didn't stick to their guns on that. OpenAI basically said, okay, you can opt out of having us hold on to what you put into the system. But the fact that ChatGPT can output Italian language text means that there's enormous amounts of Italian people's data in there that the regulator could have kept pushing about.
I take for granted that all of your work is in there.
It is a good assumption these days that anything that is, as my co-author Alex Hanna likes to say, not nailed down on the internet has been scooped up by these companies.
I know that all my work has been scraped. And if you are of the mind, you can get ChatGPT to write text in my style. And I'm sure that the style of Emily Bender can be reproduced by ChatGPT.
You know, one thing that's happened a few times, I don't know that it's ChatGPT, but I think Gemini and some of the others, I have found quotes attributed to me in journalistic articles online that are nothing I've ever said. And then I've written to the journalist saying, please take that down, I didn't say that, and gotten back an admission that they had actually just asked Gemini for an article and it came out.
Yep. Is the rule that any text created by AI, and in a minute we're going to discuss whether AI as an expression has any meaning, whatever, but is it true that any text created by AI has to be checked by a human being?
I guess it depends on what you're using it for. If your goal is to just like, you know, if you wanted a replacement for lorem ipsum to fill up some text on a page, then you wouldn't have to check what it says, I suppose. But if you are interested in using synthetic text in some communicative way where you're going to be accountable for what it says, then yeah, you'd want to check it.
Like lawyers in court.
For example, and I am shocked that so many of them keep getting in trouble for this because I would have thought that lawyers gossiped more. And the first time someone got smacked down for submitting a legal brief or filing that had fake cases cited because they just trusted ChatGPT or whatever, that people would wise up to that. But somehow there's, I think, enough marketing behind it that people keep falling for it.
Think of the time you save. Think of the billable hours that can go into your pocket by doing that.
Well, but really, because if you're saving all the time, then you've got less. If you're really billing by the hour and you're doing it faster, I don't think you're getting benefits there.
Now, you raise the fundamental point that AI in itself is a strange and really empty expression. What is AI? I note that you continue to use it, and I'm using it as well, having read what you wrote, but I think you argue that AI doesn't actually exist.
Yeah. Well, I tried my hardest not to use the phrase without taking distance from it. So I think it's okay to talk about the AI industry or the AI research field because that refers to the people who think they're working on this. But there is not a coherent set of technologies named by that label. You could say, what does artificial intelligence, the phrase, mean? It means venture capitalists, please give me some cash. Right. It's just marketing, and we are much better served by naming the technologies specifically. So, you know, are you doing synthetic text extrusion? Are you doing automatic transcription? Are you doing image classification? So talk in particular rather than lumping all that together as one thing because it's not one thing. Or if you need a more general label, we can talk about automation. And I think that that also keeps the conversation clearer.
But isn't the idea behind the term AI the notion that it is possible to make a computer actually think?
That's the goal, and that's why it's got that name to it. Drew McDermott referred to this as a wishful mnemonic, that it's basically computer programmers naming their systems after what they wish they were doing rather than what they actually do.
Where does it come from? Who first used it?
When
did it crop up?
It dates to the 1950s. So there was a summer school or summer research project at Dartmouth that was funded, I think, by U.S. military money involving John McCarthy and Marvin Minsky and a few others. And they needed a label for what they wanted to work on that sounded sort of appealing enough to attract the funds and would also differentiate them from the work of Norbert Wiener, who they didn't like, who was working on something called cybernetics. And so they came up with this term artificial intelligence and proposed that they could make, you know, good progress on this problem over the course of 8 weeks in the summer of 1956.
But what is the proof that you really draw on to say machines can't be intelligent?
So it comes in two parts. The first is that the very notion of intelligence doesn't have a good definition. So anyone who's claiming they've built an intelligent system is already like on very thin ice. It's like, how did you evaluate that? What was the experiment that you did to show that your system has this property that can't be defined? So that's one problem. Another issue, and this is where the linguistics really comes into it, is that the main reason people believe they are interacting with a system that they would call intelligent is that we are interacting through language. And I can tell you in two parts why it is that I know that ChatGPT isn't all that. On the one hand, languages are systems of signs. That is, there's always the form, the sounds that we make, the symbols that we write, and what they mean. And these systems are trained only on the form side of it. They don't have access to meaning or communicative intent. And so they can't possibly have learned it, learning in scare quotes there too, because it's not in the input data. The second thing that's really important is to think about how we understand when we understand language. It's easy to imagine that the person who's speaking took an idea, packed it into words, sent the words across, and then you just unpacked it from the words, that the meaning is in the words. In fact, what we learn from psycholinguistics is it doesn't work that way at all, that when we understand, we are picturing everything we know about the person who's speaking, what we believe to have in common ground between us and them, and what we believe that they know about us or whoever their intended audience was. And against all of that background, we ask ourselves, what must they have been trying to convey by choosing those words in that order? And what's key there is that in understanding language, we are always imagining a mind behind the text. And that's fine when it's another person that we're dealing with. But we need to learn how to take distance from it when we are doing all of that imagination looking at text that came out of ChatGPT or another one of these large language models.
Is another problem that intelligence depends to some extent on desire, and desire doesn't, and so far as we know, has not been artificially replicated?
So I think it is something about, are we talking about intelligence? Are we talking about cognition? Are we talking about consciousness? But the sort of experience of being alive is very much about navigating the world and just trying to survive as a kind of desire, I think, but also desire for connection and so on.
Yes.
And, you know, you can certainly create a computer program where the system, the algorithm basically is designed to maximize a certain kind of point, for example. And there's people who work on like automated video game playing systems, which is one of those things where you're like, well, what do we need that for? Right? What's the purpose of that?
Isn't it supposed to be played?
Yeah. But there's a story, and I'm sorry I don't have the reference to exactly who did this, but it was some system for playing one of these games where you're, I think, racing in a world and collecting certain kinds of prizes. And the system was set up to maximize a score, but there was a certain property of the game where if you basically just ran the vehicle in circles, you could get a really high score but get no closer to the end of the game. And so the system just kind of fell into that like dead end and just went around and around and around.
I don't know, Emily. That sounds like life in some of its aspects. You mentioned sources. And one of the weapons you talk about to expose the fallacies of AI is check the sources.
Yes. Yes. So one of our catchphrases in our podcast is always read the footnotes, because all of this work that looks like it's being published in scientific papers and you get this really excited journalism covering it, you dig through and the thing hasn't been peer-reviewed. It's mostly citing other things that haven't been peer-reviewed or company blog posts or things like that. And it's like, yeah, this is actually all one big fantasy world, but it's taking on the sort of shape of scientific discourse. And you have to look into it and see what's going on to figure out, is this real science or is this people who are collectively spinning a fantasy?
Those fantasies are going to become chains, aren't they? Because a false reference, you know, a made-up reference in one academic paper is going to be quoted in the next academic paper. But then perhaps a wonderful algorithm can be invented which will search the reality of sources all the way back to the start. Perhaps we could look forward to that.
Perhaps we can. I mean, there are some systems like from the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence in Seattle called Semantic Scholar. Google also has a product called Google Scholar that do citation tracking. So you can see which papers cite which other papers. If you have a fake citation and lots of people cite it, it's just going to show up in those indices as something that people cite.
This is Late Night Live. I'm David Barr. I'm talking to Emily Bender, Professor of Linguistics at the University of Washington, about her book, The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. Emily, you make the point that artificial intelligence replicates prejudice, replicates kind of some of the worst notions of the human race, sets them in mathematics.
Yes, and this becomes particularly pernicious because we are also trained to see computers as objective because they are not subjected to, you know, human emotions, desires, beliefs, biases, right? So they're set up as objective and also painted as all-knowing. We've trained this on everything we could download from the internet. And so that gives us this idea that there is this like view from nowhere and it's got lots of viewpoints in it. And so therefore it is going to be objective. When in fact, if you actually drill into these data sets, you can see that they are not even the best we could possibly do given the internet as a starting point. And then you end up with these statistical systems that are designed to find and replicate the patterns in the input data. And those patterns are going to replicate, you know, our historical systems of oppression. There's a researcher, Dr. Abeba Berhane, who points out that any kind of machine learning is inherently conservative in the sense that it sets up the patterns of the past as a good way to build the future.
And those patterns can be dreadful.
Indeed.
What happens when the huge amounts of money that you talk about that are pouring into AI, you know, get up at a conference and say, you know, I've got an AI breakthrough here, and to believe your book, billions flow. What happens when that money doesn't earn money?
You know, it's interesting, and this is really a question more for an economist or maybe my co-author who's a sociologist than for a linguist. But it is surprising to me that the bubble has gone on as far as it has, because these systems are really not making that much money. I mean, you've got NVIDIA that makes the chips that everyone needs to run these systems. They're making money. But OpenAI is just burning cash. And they are still somehow, you know, the player to beat that everyone wants to be like, even though they don't have a business model. And we have been through this once before, right? At least once before. So the dot-com bubble of the late 1990s, you know, crashed pretty hard. My concern is that the crash, and this is a part of the book called The Grimy Residue of the AI Bubble, that is due initially to Alex. She talks there about how we have, you know, not just the loss of, like, you know, retirement funds and things like that, but also all of these systems that have been sort of deformed to work around the idea that the synthetic text extruding machine is actually going to solve all of our problems. And then you take that thing out, which wasn't really working, but we had sort of oriented towards it anyway, and we're going to have a lot of recovery to do in terms of rehiring people, in terms of recreating career pathways that have been damaged in the process of everyone orienting towards this imagined artificial intelligence.
But even if the system sort of turns out to be financially tacky, even if the system is not as dangerous as our worst fears, there is still this notion that's been instilled in us now for 20 or 30 years of anthropomorphizing the work of machines. What's that doing to us?
Yeah. I think just at the level of the hype, anthropomorphizing language is a real problem. And it is, I think, both valuable and entertaining to catch the words that we use and find ways to rephrase. So when we say, I asked ChatGPT something, just using that word ask is setting up the system as something that can be in a conversation. And even the chat and chatbot has that property. Right. So one of my colleagues challenged me to figure out a non-anthropomorphizing term for chatbot, because those are systems that exist. We need a word for them. And I think a good word is conversation simulator, because that tells you what it's doing. But every time we talk about these things as thinking, as knowing, as answering, as struggling, as making mistakes, we are setting them up as something that isn't just a system that has a specific function, but maybe could be like us in some way, and maybe could be trusted to do things, and maybe we could displace accountability onto those systems. And so I think it's worthwhile to resist the anthropomorphizing language at every turn.
Or maybe like us and cannot be trusted and will take over the world.
So, yes, but that's also, you know, not a great way of thinking about it. And I think ultimately, even a person that you can't trust is a person who could be held accountable. And that's just not true of machines. And so we need to be sure to keep the people in the frame, the people who did all the data work behind it, and also the people who are making these deployment decisions, and not say AI is doing these harms, but rather companies in the name of AI or companies trying to build AI are doing these harms.
So the way we think about it, the way we talk about it, is necessary for the solution to the problems AI raises. Is that really your argument?
That is a part of it. I think it is valuable to recognize the language and to use different language. When I'm talking with someone and they say something full of anthropomorphizing language, I can call them on that and I think make what's at issue much, much clearer.
Will we ever have self-driving cars?
So that is what do you mean by self-driving car, right? If you've got a system that's being monitored remotely and a person is stepping in 5% of the time to help it out of sticky situations, is that a self-driving car?
Not in my view, no. No, we're talking about a vehicle that goes along the road while everybody in the vehicle is reading their phones.
And nobody outside the vehicle is controlling it.
Nobody outside the vehicle. The vehicle itself is avoiding collisions, making moral choices about who to hit on the footpath, and taking you to the coffee shop without any intervention from the passengers or anybody outside the car. Self-driving.
So there are the Waymo taxis in California. I'm given to understand that Tesla has some sort of a pilot happening right now in Texas. I don't know to what extent those systems are completely free of external like pilots. I know that one of them, I'm not going to remember which company it was found to have a whole workforce in Mexico monitoring the cars that were supposedly self-driving in the U.S. And I think for Waymo, I remember learning recently that they have a whole protocol for interacting with the police when a car gets stuck, because they do have some sort of remote supervision of the cars, but there's only so much you can do if you are not there in place. And so they're basically relying on the police to help them out.
An alternative would be to have a human being sitting behind a steering wheel.
Yeah, for example. And then it's like, okay, well, are we better off having that person not paying much attention, but trying to like snap into focus at a moment's notice when needed versus having that person actually be a driver? Just one other thing, if we want to solve issues around transportation, there's other things like trams and trains that go on dedicated tracks that can carry many more people at the same time.
So old-fashioned, Emily. You are so old-fashioned. You don't downplay the dangers of what we still have to call artificial intelligence. What do you see as the main danger of artificial intelligence being allowed to develop unchecked in the way that it has been over the last decade or so?
So I would put the people in the frame phrasing that. I don't think AI is autonomously developing unchecked. I think what we have are massive concentrations of data, of wealth, of computing resources. And I see a lot of harm just in that very concentration. And it is being unchecked, I think, by regulation. But the regulation isn't, oh, we have to regulate so-called artificial intelligence. It's more along the lines of, should we put limits on the extent to which data centers can use electrical and water resources? Should we put limits, and I think we very much should, on the extent to which data can be amassed? Right? We need data minimization principles, which we really don't have in the U.S. Europe's doing a little bit better. I don't know the situation here in Australia. But these are the kinds of things where I think we really want to keep control over data and what's known about us individually at the individual and community level, and not just surrender to the idea that if a company can grab hold of it, then they have the right to have it.
And what gives you most hope?
What gives me the most hope? I think seeing people connecting with each other realizing that our own value and lived experience and expertise is highly relevant in these conversations. And every time I see someone say, yeah, actually, I do have something to say here, you don't have to be the expert in building the automation to have really valuable and, in fact, probably the most important opinions around when and how we should be automating something. It's the people who are using the automation, and especially the people who are having it used on them, that I think should have the most say there.
And don't ever believe the bullshit.
Exactly.
Emily, thank you for joining me on Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me. It's been a delightful conversation.
I have been speaking to Emily Bender, Professor of Linguistics at the University of Washington, about her new book, The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. And that's the show. The great British actor Dame Harriet Walter joins me on our next. If you didn't know her before, you discovered Harriet Walter as the English wife of Logan Roy in the TV hit Succession. But with me, she talked Shakespeare and the lives she imagined for Shakespeare's women. Looked at her way, Hamlet's mother was only too happy to marry her husband's killer, it was love.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.